Right. United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary F. Katzman presiding before court number 23-00182, Nine Star Corporation et al. Versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
The plaintiff, Nine Star. Defendants, Your Honor, Warden Todd Vasily Austin. With me are Cody Akins and Ted Murphy.
Morning.
On behalf of the United States, Monica Trunata. I'm here with Guy Edding, Luke Mathers, Jeffrey Miller, and Claudia Burke.
Good morning. May I be seated? Morning, Council. We are here this morning on the hearing on a plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction and the motion to unseal and unredact the administrative record. I think it might be helpful to begin with some general introductory remarks that put this case in context and the litigation in context. Plaintiffs, Nine Star Corporation, and its corporate affiliates are Chinese companies, specifically manufacturers and sellers of laser printers and printer-related products, who initiated this suit against defendants, the United States, and various federal agencies and officials before this court, the United States Court of International Trade. The plaintiffs challenge a decision by the Interagency Forced Labor Enforcement Task Force, FLETF, pardon the acronyms, but I know that you can all retain this in your head, a decision to add plaintiffs to the entity list of the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, UFLPA, a list compiled to presumptively prohibit the importation of goods produced by forced labor. Plaintiffs filed the initial complaint on August 22, 2023, alleging that the task force, FLETF's decision to add plaintiffs to the entity list was arbitrary and capricious under the Administrative Procedure Act because the FLETF failed to adequately explain its decision. Federal law has long prohibited the importation of foreign goods made by forced labor. Section 307 of the Tariff Act of 1930 states in relevant part, all goods, wares, articles, and merchandise mined, produced, or manufactured wholly or in part in any foreign country by foreign labor shall not be entitled to entry at any of the ports of the United States, and the importation thereof is hereby prohibited. Section 307 further defines forced labor as all work or service which is exacted from any person under the menace of any penalty for its non-performance and for which the worker does not offer himself voluntarily, and includes forced child labor. More recently, in the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement Implementation Act of 2020, Congress directed the President to establish the Forced Labor Enforcement Task Force, referenced already, FLETF, to monitor the United States enforcement and prohibition under Section 307 of the Tariff Act of 1930. Per the statute, the President's subsequent executive order, the FLETF is chaired by the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and comprises seven member agencies, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, the United States Trade Representative, and the Departments of Justice, Labor, State, Treasury, and Commerce. The FLETF also includes six observer agencies. Following reports of forced labor and ongoing genocide in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of the People's Republic of China, Congress passed and signed into law the ULFPA in December 2021. Per the text of the statute, the UFLPA is designed to, quote, strengthen the prohibition against the importation of goods made with forced labor, including by ensuring that the government of the People's Republic of China does not undermine the effective enforcement of Section 307 of the Tariff Act of 1930. Section 307 of the Tariff Act, moreover, prohibits the importation of merchandise created wholly or in part by forced labor, as referenced. The FLETF's decision, the task force decision, to add plaintiffs to the entity list of the UFLPA presumptively prohibits, under Section 307, the importation of any goods produced by the plaintiffs. That prohibition is now in effect. Plaintiffs filed a motion for preliminary injunction alongside the complaint on August 22nd, 2023, requesting that the court, one, stay the listing decision, and two, prevent defendants from taking any action against the importation of plaintiffs' goods predicated on the listing decision. On October 3rd, 2023, defendants moved to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and for failure to state a claim and responded in opposition to the plaintiff's motion for preliminary injunction. Plaintiffs filed a reply on October 13, 2023. Defendants also filed a confidential administrative record that plaintiff's counsel, but not plaintiffs, could review under the terms of the amended judicial protective order. Certain portions of the confidential administrative record are redacted, even to plaintiff's counsel, and the court ordered a privilege log documenting defendant's reasons for redaction. Additionally, pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 2635 D2 and U.S. Court of International Trade Administrative Order Number 21-01, the court ordered that the defendants file paper copies of the fully unredacted administrative record and move to treat such submissions as highly sensitive documents, and the court granted that motion. The paper copies of the fully unredacted administrative record are now stored securely with the court for in-camera review. A preliminary injunction hearing was initially scheduled for November 2nd, 2023, but was ultimately postponed to December 7th, 2023 because the parties have been exploring the possibility of negotiating a process for the FLETF's, the task force, consideration of a request of removal from the entity list. On November 30th, 2023, the court issued an opinion holding that plaintiffs are likely to establish the United States Court of International Trade's exclusive subject matter jurisdiction over this action under 28 U.S.C. Section 1581 I-1 because the ULFTA is a law providing for embargoes. That case is available on the court's website, Nine Star Corporation versus United States, Slip Opinion 23-169, CIT, Court of International Trade, November 30th, 2023, and also will be published in the Federal Reporter, can also be found at 2023 Westlaw 827-7753. On December 4th, 2023, the parties filed a joint status report indicating that the parties were unable to negotiate an out-of-court process. On the same day, plaintiffs filed a motion to unseal and unredact the administrative record. The court held a status conference on the following day regarding next steps in the litigation, after which plaintiffs moved to amend the complaint to add three new causes of action. The court granted the motion the next day. Specifically, count two of the amended complaint alleges arbitrary and capricious agency action as unsupported by substantial evidence. Count three alleges agency action in excess of statutory authority for the task force use of a burden of proof that is below preponderance of the evidence. And count four alleges agency action in excess of statutory authority for having applied the UFLPA's, the statute at issue here, provisions retroactively. On December 8th, the court issued a scheduling order. In that scheduling order, the court ordered supplemental briefing for the preliminary injunction motion in light of the newly amended complaint, denied the defendant's motion to dismiss it as moot without prejudice to renewal, and set forth dates for briefs related to the motion to unredact and unseal the forthcoming motion for judgment on the agency record and other motions concerning the record. Plaintiffs filed their supplemental brief in support of the preliminary injunction motion on December 15th, 2023. Defendants did not renew their motion to dismiss and instead filed an answer. On January 3rd, 2024, defendants filed a supplemental response in opposition to plaintiffs' preliminary injunction motion, which to which plaintiffs replied on January 10th, 2024. Regarding the motion to unseal and unredact the administrative record, defendants filed their response on January 8, 2024, and plaintiffs replied on January 15, 2024. In defendants' response to the motion to unseal, defendants agreed to disclosure of certain portions of the confidential administrative record to Nine Star. Plaintiffs filed a motion seeking immediate leave for such disclosure on January 9, 2024. The court denied the motion as premature and requested a proposed modification to the existing judicial protective order. Upon review of the party's proposed modification and defendant's modification of the confidential administrative record to indicate which portions of the record may be disclosed with plaintiffs, the court adopted defendant's modifications and ordered that plaintiff's counsel could share certain confidential information with their clients. With briefing in hand, the court now begins the hearing on the two motions, the plaintiff's motion for preliminary injunction and plaintiff's motion to unseal and unredact the administrative record. as was set forth in a letter from the court filed on January 12, 2024, to counsel, letters regarding the hearing on plaintiff's motion for preliminary injunction and plaintiff's motion to unseal, and an unredacted the administrative record letter, which is docketed and available to the public. It is set forth that the hearing will be public in part and closed in part. The first part of the hearing, encompassing the introductory remarks by the court, and you've heard some of those remarks, and there will be a quiz at the end. I will be asking about when something happened, you know, what the date, what it was all about, but just kidding. There will be opening statements and arguments relating to exhaustion, which I will note in somewhat further detail, the question of exhaustion of remedies. That portion of the argument will be recorded and made available to the public via the court's website. So you can go on the website, and anybody can, and hear the public portion of this hearing, and you've already heard the beginning of the remarks from the court. But due to issues concerning confidential information and the administrative record that are raised by the parties, the remainder of the hearing will be closed. That said, as indicated in the letter of January 12, 2024, what is set forth are questions for the public session and also questions for the closed session. So the public knows what is being discussed and considered in this hearing. The parties will first be invited to make opening statements of 7 minutes each. In the public session of the argument, the parties will each have 10 minutes to discuss exhaustion, followed by 2 minutes for rebuttal. In the closed session, the parties will each have 20 minutes, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal to discuss the remaining issues in the motion for preliminary injunction. The parties will then have 10 minutes, followed by 2 minutes of rebuttal to argue the motion to unseal. Additional time may be granted upon request and consideration by the court. And as noted, the court circulated questions for oral argument in its letter to the parties on January 12, 2024, to assist in the consideration of the issues that are before the court. And as the parties know, the court is very much cognizant of all the filings in this case. So, now, in the letter of January 12th, the court indicated that the parties could propose modifications to the public confidential nature, structure, timing, and ordering of the issues in the hearing in writing. And that would be done by Tuesday, January 16, 2024, at 5 p.m. There has been no request for modification by any of the parties. Let me ask counsel, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
For the government?
Correct.
For NYSTAR, right. Let us begin the questions that are part of the public session. And before we begin with the question questioning regarding exhaustion of remedies. The government has argued initially in its motion to dismiss that this court lacks subject matter jurisdiction because the Nine Star had failed to exhaust administrative remedies. Even though the government did not renew its motion to dismiss after filing the amended complaint, the court understands the exhaustion argument to be incorporated into the government's defense on the motion for preliminary injunction, and Nine Star has addressed it in its reply on the motion for preliminary injunction. The Supreme Court has held that where the APA applies, exhaustion of administrative remedies is prerequisite to judicial review only when expressly required by statute or when an agency rule requires appeal before review of the administrative action is made inoperative pending that review. Additionally, per 28 United States Code, Section 2637D, the Court of International Trade shall, where appropriate, require the exhaustion of administrative remedies. And the court will be very much interested in hearing everything that the counsel has to say in this case. The exhaustion of remedies question is of certainly extremely significant. That is basically presented to, you know, for some background on exhaustion, but I think we can actually first begin, before we even get into exhaustion, with opening statements more broadly. Each party will have 7 minutes. We'll ask counsel for Nine Star. 7 minutes. You'll have a chance to come back, you know, so don't worry.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I just say, preliminarily, it's very nice to be here in person. Yes. And I want to thank the court and the court staff for its patience with this case as we tried to work through it. Your Honor, this case is about holding the United States government to its own standards. The U.S. is a great force for moral good in the world when it speaks with moral clarity, something that is desperately needed. But when the government mounts the podium of public approbation, we should take care to make sure that our own house is in order, that we've abided by our principles, that we haven't casually discarded them as inconvenient, because doing so undercuts our authority and gives cover to our competition. We criticize other countries, totalitarian, communist regimes, when they don't measure up to our standards, failure to provide due process, lack of individual rights, lack of an impartial judiciary, lack of transparency. We claim to be open and transparent. We pride ourselves on the rule of law, not the rule of man. And not just substantively, but procedurally. For without procedural protections, all the substantive rights in the world are fairly meaningless. The APA, at the risk of sounding like a law dork, is a wonderful thing. I don't know if it's unique among the community of nations, but it certainly is a hallmark of American jurisprudence. It establishes rules for government, how government will make decisions, and how those decisions will be communicated to the governed public. And as I said, those procedural rules are every bit as important as the underlying substantive rules. This case is about whether the government met its obligations under the APA, and it did not. Before the court, as Your Honor has noted, is a motion for a preliminary injunction. And Your Honor well knows the elements, likelihood of success on the merits, irreparable harm, balance of harms, and the public interest. And these are, of course, evaluated on a sliding scale, where irreparable harm and the equitable factors strongly weigh in favor of an injunction. A plaintiff needs show only a fair likelihood of succeeding on the merits. Here, however, Your Honor, all four prongs weigh strongly in favor of issuing preliminary relief. Let me start with irreparable harm. There's no serious question that Nine Star has been injured and injured seriously. And the fact that harm is purposeful, the UFLPA is intended to cause grievous harm, and it is causing grievous harm. Financial harm, harm to business relationships and prospective business opportunities, and harm to reputation. And the last is really the most serious in a manner of speaking, because NineStar has been convicted in the court of public opinion based on an administrative record that is largely invisible to the public, something that NineStar cannot fight against. The balance of harms in the public interest also weighs strongly in favor of an injunction. The government argues at length that forced labor is bad. Of course forced labor is bad. No one here contends otherwise, counsel or client. But the government has no legitimate interest in misapplying, in overapplying substantive law, and no right and no interest in misapplying the APA. Indeed, doing so undercuts our moral authority and whatever persuasive authority statutes such as the UFLPA may have. The equitable factors come down to a simple question. What happens to the plaintiffs if an injunction does not issue? And what happens to defendants if one does? To take those in reverse order, for defendants, if the court issues an injunction, the government suffers no measurable or appreciable loss. It can fully enforce its embargo when it prevails on the merits. And given the court's schedule, hopefully we get to the merits pretty quickly. For plaintiffs, on the other hand, if the court does not issue an injunction, NineStar will continue to suffer massive losses, lose business relationships, and see its reputation torched. Clearly, Your Honor, we support issuing an injunction. And lastly, we come to likelihood of success on the merits. I took a step back yesterday, and I tried to think about what this case looks like to someone on the outside looking in. We, counsel, the parties, the court, have seen the administrative record. Your Honor's seen all of it. We've seen most of it. And so we've lived with it for a number of months and have an understanding of what's really going on here. But someone on the outside, the casual observer, the press, they see only the government's manicured view of this case, the careful disclosures, the handful of pages the government has chose to release. And based on that, one may well come to the conclusion that there is a mountain of evidence that shows that NineStar recruits Uyghur laborers in Xinjiang province and transports them to NineStar facilities and cooperates with the Chinese government in so doing. The government asserts in its briefs and in the portion of its cover memo that it released, asserts that NineStar documents and PRC documents and media documents all support and substantiate this view. But yet the government has fought tooth and nail to prevent those documents from becoming public. Why? Because it's simply not true. I can't say what is in the confidential record, but I can say what's not. There is no NineStar document that says that NineStar hires Uyghur laborers in Xinjiang and transports them to NineStar facilities and works with the government to do so. There is no PRC document and no media document to substantiate that. The government's case is based on secret evidence, slim reads, and rank speculation. On the merits, Your Honor, the APA requires the government to tie the facts and the law to the decision made. The list at which NineStar was put on requires or asserts that NineStar cooperates, works with the government of Xinjiang province to recruit, transport, harbor laborers. The record fails to substantiate that claim. To bolster its claim, the government improperly relies on stale evidence, which either unlawfully retroactively applies a statute or fails to meet the statutory command that the listed entity be currently working with the government of Xinjiang province. Again, not substantiated. And lastly, the government tries to stitch its record together by applying an absurdly low burden of proof. There is a clear preponderance, or a clear presumption in American law that the preponderance of evidence standard applies to agency fact-finding and agency adjudication of all sort. Here, the government has improperly applied a reasonable suspicion test, basically the Terry stop standard, which allows a police officer to stop and frisk someone on the street to make sure the police officer is not at risk. That's a really low standard, Your Honor. And based on that finding, that some evidence might support the government's case, they have imposed a complete 100% death penalty embargo on NineStar. Your Honor, that should not stand, and preliminary injunctive relief should issue. Thank you.
Thanks, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning. It's Triana.
The court should dismiss this matter so that plaintiffs can exhaust their administrative remedies and seek their desired relief before the agency, which is removal from the UFLPA entity list, before this court is required to make that same determination. Plaintiffs have bypassed this step, seeking instead for the court to provide that relief without a more fulsome administrative record. 28 U.S.C. 2637D affords the court the discretion to apply the prudential exhaustion principles and to require dismissal here. Such resolution would serve the dual purposes of the exhaustion requirement, preserving the administrative authority in an area where the plaintiff has significant expertise, and promoting judicial efficiency in preparing a fulsome record for this court to review. But even if this court does not dismiss, injunctive relief must be denied here. Interestingly, plaintiffs have steadfastly avoided any discussion of the substantive reasons for plaintiffs' placement on the UFLPA entity list, and even here didn't assert that as a basis for their likelihood of success. Indeed, plaintiffs have never challenged the accuracy of the information in the record, which undoubtedly supports the listing determination, instead arguing that government simply failed to connect the dots in making its listing decision. As will be established in the closed session today, the explanation provided in the administrative record is reasoned and supported. Plaintiff herein attempts to support its request for injunctive relief based only on their procedural challenges, challenges that are not likely to succeed here. However, even a victory on those grounds will only afford plaintiffs with a remand and a potential return to this court in the future. But plaintiffs still have not justified its request for the extraordinary remedy of a preliminary injunction. They simply cannot establish that they are likely to succeed on any of their procedural claims. As to count one, plaintiffs maintain the contention that their addition to the UFLPA entity list was without a reasoned explanation, making the determination arbitrary and capricious and in violation of the APA. Plaintiff's analysis is wrong, and in any event, the government has now provided a more fulsome explanation through its administrative record on numerous occasions, and now that claim is moot. And that the administrative record was properly redacted to protect a confidential source as well as law enforcement sensitive information does not make that decision arbitrary and capricious. The case law plaintiff cites to support the requirement of a public explanation is an opposite. As to count three, the standard applied by the plaintiff in making its listing determination, reasonable cause to believe based on specific and articulable evidence, is entirely proper for several reasons. First, it's consistent with the statutory and regulatory framework in place, both under Section 307 of the Tariff Act and the UFLPA, both of which were enacted to ensure that goods made in whole or in part with forced labor are not permitted entry here. The standard is almost identical to the burden applied in analogous situations, both under Section 307 and the implementing regulation and in the context of OFAC, Office of Foreign Assets Control. The APA does not itself require a preponderance of evidence standard for all informal decision-making. The identified case law reflects the necessity of considering not only the statutory language, but the protected interest that's in question with each administrative determination when considering the proper burden of proof. Here, plaintiffs have no protected interest at stake that would warrant a greater burden of proof by the plaintiffs. There is no statutorily protected interest that the listing decision takes away. The plaintiffs have no constitutional due process rights here, and no company has a right to import its merchandise or have its merchandise entered into the U.S. stream of commerce. A reasonable cause to believe is entirely improper here. As to count four, the government has not applied the UFLPA retroactively. There is simply no evidence of this. As not only are plaintiffs unlikely to succeed on the merits of their procedural challenges, but plaintiffs have not met the remaining requirements necessary for a preliminary injunction by clear and convincing evidence, and this motion should be denied. In particular, the evidence supporting a claim of irreparable harm must be concrete, it must be corroborated, and it must be substantial. Plaintiffs cannot satisfy that burden through the Chang Declaration. Indeed, the declarations are not properly verified, and the veracity cannot be tested. Because plaintiffs cannot establish the necessary PI preliminary injunction factors by clear and convincing evidence, this motion must be denied. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks, counsel.
I'm going to reserve those 2 minutes and 25 seconds for another part of my presentation today.
Thanks, counsel. So before we actually go into the questions on the issue of exhaustion, I do want to note for the record And that's all, it's already part of the record. It's noted in our letter of the court's letter to counsel, January 12, 2024, that the questions that have been posed to the counsel, for consideration to facilitate the court's consideration of the issues here, should not be construed as an indication that the court has come to any conclusions with respect to those issues. And also to note that the court's decisions on the plaintiff's two motions will be published in a public document. So I think it's important for the public to understand what these cases are about, what the processes are about. Also, I would state for the record that in this hearing on the motion for preliminary injunction, there has been no request for any live witness testimony. Is that right, counsel?
Correct, Your
Honor. No, thank you. Let's proceed with the, and this is part of the public session, with the questions for Nine Star, focusing on the issue of exhaustion of remedies.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, exhaustion is not required in an APA case absent an express statutory directive. The Supreme Court held that very clearly and unambiguously in the Darby case. In that case, the court explained that Section 10C of the APA, 5 U.S.C. 704, requires judicial review of final agency action unless a statute specifically directs otherwise. Therefore, in an APA case, administrative exhaustion is required only when A, required by statute, or B, required by regulation, where the final agency action is suspended during the course of the review. Neither requirement is met here. The APA clearly applies. The government does not contend otherwise. The UFLPA does not expressly require exhaustion, administrative exhaustion, of a challenge to a listing decision. The government does not contend otherwise. And the regulatory delisting process which exists here is on its face permissive and does not suspend the listing decision during the course of any review. The Federal Circuit has been likewise unambiguous in applying Darby. And this is, and I quote, this is from Martinez versus United States, 333 F3rd 1295 at 1305. When the APA applies, quote, courts may not require exhaustion of administrative remedies except where exhaustion is expressly required by statute or rule. And so that, Your Honor, brings us to the statute which Your Honor has raised, 28 U.S.C. 2637D. And the question is, does that supply the express command for exhaustion of remedies in a UFLPA case?
Right. That says the United States, it says the Court of International Trade shall, where appropriate, require the exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Precisely, Your Honor. And so that the question is, does that satisfy the Darby standard? We could find no case discussing Darby and that statutory provision. So we have nothing, no precedent putting them together. What we should recognize at the outset is that 2637D is permissive, not mandatory, and therefore doesn't satisfy the first prong of the Darby test. And I could cite, Your Honor, a half dozen cases from the CIT and the Federal Circuit holding that. I'd give one. I can give more if Your Honor likes, but it's Choku Building Products versus U.S., 773 F3rd, 1140, Federal Circuit 2013. And I cite that case in particular because it goes on to note that because the statute is permissive, the Federal Circuit reviews it only for abuse of discretion. Now, it's important to recognize secondarily that Congress knows full well how to mandate exhaustion when it wants to. In fact, if you look at the statute Your Honor directs us to, 28 U.S.C. 2637, and if you look two provisions up from subsection D, and you look at subsection B, it reads, a civil action contesting the denial of a petition under Section 516 of the Tariff Act of 1930 may be commenced in the Court of International Trade only by a person who has first exhausted the procedures set forth in subsection. Congress knows exactly how to make exhaustion mandatory. That's a mandatory exhaustion provision. Subsection D is permissive and therefore does not satisfy Darby. Now, the court asks us to then indulge the hypothetical if 2637D nonetheless applies, should exhaustion prudentially be required here? And we argue, Your Honor, it does not for a number of reasons. First, even where a statute does not speak expressly to an issue, we should still look at the text and start with the text. And we should do that because courts have an unflagging obligation to exercise their jurisdiction and should turn away from it only when consistent with congressional intent as reflected in the statute. The UFLPA does not point towards requiring exhaustion. In the statute, Congress did provide an express administrative remedy for challenging the for seeking the entry of goods on an entry-by-entry-by-entry basis. That's in the statute. But nothing with respect to administrative exhaustion as to a listing decision in the first instance. The effect of a listing decision similarly points towards a need for judicial review. It has an immediate, dramatic, and profound real-world effect, blocking 100% of a listed entity's goods from entry into the country.
But the fact that judicial review is appropriate doesn't resolve the question as to whether there should first be exhaustion. Subject to judicial review.
Prudentially, that's true, Your Honor, and that's why I would go back to the Federal Circuit's description of Darby, that the court may not require exhaustion. Where not expressly required. That would, to my reading, that encompasses prudential review. But indulging the hypothetical of should prudential review nonetheless be considered, we'd point secondly that exhaustion is not appropriate where an agency fails to provide a meaningful public explanation. Exhaustion is intended in part to promote judicial efficiency, requiring a party, and this is ex ante, we're indulging this hypothetical ex ante before we file a lawsuit and have the administrative record, requiring a party to go to an agency where the party has no information as to why it's been subject to the treatment it's been subject to does nothing to tee up an issue better for judicial review. And that's why the CIT and the Federal Circuit have held repeatedly that lack of access to a confidential record is a well-established exception to any exhaustion requirement. I cite the court to Gerber Foods versus United States, 601 F sub 2nd, 1370. Ta Chen Stainless Steel Pipe versus United States, 342 F sub 2nd, 1191. Sigma Corp versus United States, 841 F sub 1275, and numerous other cases. The court has repeatedly held that if you don't have access to the record, you're not required to exhaust, you can go straight to court. Thirdly, Your Honor, prudential exhaustion would not be appropriate under the facts of this case. First, the history of this litigation. We're now months and months into it. The government has fought tooth and nail to prevent us from learning the administrative record, to keep it redacted, didn't even file it with the court initially as required. Requiring exhaustion at this point, sending us back to the agency, would simply reward bad behavior, Your Honor. The delisting process, such as we understand it, is moreover inadequate. Again, a well-recognized exemption to any exhaustion requirement is where the process is ill-defined and indeterminate. I would cite the court to Coit Independent Joint Venture versus Federal Savings and Loans, 489 U.S. 561. The lack of a reasonable time limit renders the administrative procedure inadequate for several reasons. It need not be exhausted. The CIT has, again, applied that rule in a number of cases. Here, FLEDA's delisting procedure has no time frame and no procedures at all. It is a black box, and it is our understanding that every company that has gone into it has received no response at all. And that's not something that my client could endure. Particularly with respect to the irreparable harm that we detailed and that we'll talk about later.
The hypotheticals, which you also referenced that the court presented for consideration, let's return to those hypotheticals. Why could Nine Star, not have submitted evidence showing that their hiring practices and employment records do demonstrate that they do not engage in the prohibited practices relating to forced labor? Yeah.
And that's a great question, Your Honor, and really brings us to the root of the matter. I mean, the simple answer is Nine Star could have, as a functional matter, I mean, the question is, why couldn't we? Of course, we could have gone to the agency and said truthfully, we don't hire Uyghur laborers in Xinjiang province. We don't cooperate with the government of Xinjiang province. We are not doing the things that the listing seems to require.
Or, statements by corporate officers regarding ethical conduct and their opposition to forced labor practices. Put differently, and this has also been presented for consideration, why does a challenge to the listing decision for the purpose of exhausting remedies require knowledge of the specific information before the agency?
Here's why, Your Honor. We could make those showings, or we could attempt to, but the question is, first, are we required to? And the answer to that is no, we're not required to, as I've already covered. Secondly, to what end? As FLEDF describes publicly its delisting process, and this is in the Federal Register notice that announced Nine Star's listing and every other similar Federal Register notice, it says the company should come in and demonstrate, it makes submissions, that it no longer meets or didn't meet the elements of the relevant list. That seems fairly innocuous on its face. If you go, however, Your Honor, to, and I'm going to cite the court to Administrative Record, page 221, which is FLEDF's SOP, which they've submitted, and that's still under seal. So I can't say out loud what it requires. I can't read its text. The government has, I believe, in the exchange over unsealing the record, they agreed to unseal that, but it's not unsealed yet, I don't think. So I don't want to say out loud what it says specifically, but I will characterize it thusly. It will require Nine Star to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, that it does not meet the standards for listing. And that means, and instead, as I discussed in my opening, the government applied a, am I finished the answer, Your Honor?
Please finish the sentence, yeah.
Oh, I need a few more sentences to answer your question, if I may.
We can do that, Mr. Skull. Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government applies a standard which basically asks, is there some evidence? A very, very low standard, is there some evidence? The flip side of that is beyond reasonable doubt. Disprove every bit of evidence. We could go in and say, we don't hire Uyghurs from Xinjiang province, we're not cooperating with the government, and the government could say, we believe you, but we have this other bit of evidence which says you are. They're in equipoise. You don't meet the standard for delisting, as secretly defined in the SOP by the government. Listing would be completely and utterly futile, Your Honor, or attempting to delist that way would be futile without understanding not just what the government thinks at a macro level, but specifically what their evidence is, because if we can't rebut it, we can't get off the list. Thank you, Your Honor.
Just one quick sort of factual question. I think you indicated that it was your understanding that no company has successfully delisted.
There was a news report a couple of weeks ago, and I can find it and submit it to the court, which said that. I don't independently know that to be true. I don't think FLEDF publishes any statistics or whatever is going on there. So my friends over here would know better than I. But as best we know, no one's been off the list.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now hear from the government.
USC 2637D is a codification of the prudential exhaustion doctrine in the Court of International Trade and applies with respect to cases brought under 1581I, such as this case. Specifically, as Your Honor mentioned, it says that any civil action not specified in this section, the Court of International Trade shall, where appropriate, require the exhaustion of administrative remedies. As the Federal Circuit noted in the Coristal case, although the statutory injunction is not absolute, it indicates a congressional intent that absent a strong contrary reason, the court should insist that parties exhaust their remedies before the pertinent administrative agencies. This is consistent with the prudential exhaustion doctrine, which applies where exhaustion is not required by statute, but applicable as a matter of judicial discretion. And dismissal under this doctrine serves the dual purposes of exhaustion, both of which are relevant here. Preserving agencies' administrative authority, especially whereas here the agency has particular expertise in this area. As Your Honor mentioned, FLETIP is made up of 7 member agencies and a number of observer agencies, but they all have specialized expertise particularly relevant with respect to forced labor, and it's tasked by statute with monitoring U.S. enforcement of the prohibition under 307 of the Tariff Act. This expertise makes them uniquely situated to consider new evidence that plaintiffs may provide, and the agency should be permitted to address this removal before the court addresses the same issue here. The second purpose of the exhaustion involves promoting judicial efficiency in developing a useful record for the court's consideration, and participation in the removal proceedings would help in this respect. The procedures set out in the Federal Register notice, they allow the plaintiff to petition for removal from the list to include information that demonstrates that they no longer meet the statutory criteria necessary for a listing decision, and information that plaintiff is best equipped to identify. As Your Honor mentioned, plaintiffs are in the best position to know their recruitment practices, including their participation in the poverty alleviation programs or other programs that include the transfer of workers to their facility. They know their hiring practice. They have their employment records and any records related to participation in poverty alleviation. They can address the idea of, or the presence of Uyghurs working in their facility. They have all of this information, and they have ample opportunity to provide this information and let it be considered by the experts in making a determination here. In addition, it allows the FLETIP to ask questions in aid of its determination. It allows the plaintiff to ask for a meeting, and a decision in writing is then going to be provided to the plaintiff here. Here, plaintiffs are just attempting to make a request for removal to the court without having it ever considered by the agencies.
Counsel, with respect to this case, initially, the plaintiffs, the initial complaint said that they had not been provided with, adequate notice as to the nature of the grounds for the listing. Subsequently, the JPO, the administrative record, much of that was provided to the plaintiffs. Is it your view that there would be enough information that could have been provided by Nine Star to the agency?
It's my view that there was enough that could have been provided to the FLETIF both before the administrative record was more fully disclosed to them and now. At the time, the listing was based on working with the government of Xinjiang basically to transfer laborers from the Uyghur region. Just based on that, there was enough for plaintiff to have provided the information I just identified, the employment records, any indication of labor transfers from the Xinjiang region that could have been provided. At this point, now they have almost the entire record. Plaintiff's counsel has it. Plaintiffs themselves have almost the entire record and certainly could provide information to the extent there is any information before the FLETIF for them to consider, for the experts to consider in a delisting determination. Plaintiffs simply didn't avail the FLETIF of that particular of that opportunity. And again, it promotes judicial efficiency in developing a more fulsome record for the court to consider. If the plaintiff wants the court to consider, to the extent they don't get a favorable outcome in their delisting process, to the extent the plaintiffs want the court to consider whether a decision was arbitrary and capricious, that should be done on a more fulsome record here.
Can I ask you to also address the second question that we posed to counsel?
Sure.
Assuming 2637D applies, is there case law applying 2637 that supports the argument that exhaustion is appropriate here and not indefinite, futile, or inadequate under circumstances that are comparable to this case?
Certainly, I would agree with plaintiff's counsel. There's not a wealth of case law out there on 2637.
And when you say wealth, is there any case law?
As we articulated in our there are cases that discuss 2637 outside the context of a trade case, of a commerce case, and that's the B-West imports case versus the United States. They do apply the 2637 doctrine in that case. They don't require exhaustion because based on the specifics of the process that was available to the plaintiffs in that case. But it is available. 2637 was applicable in that case, and Judge Rustani, I believe it was Judge Rustani, did apply it. But as we articulated in our opening brief, a number of considerations should be viewed in deciding whether the prudential exhaustion doctrine applies, all of which favor dismissal here. Those are set forth in McCarthy versus Madigan, and those same considerations are considered in the CIT when they apply 2637. Those are, would the administrative remedy occasion undue prejudice, such as unreasonable delay? Is the remedy inadequate remedy because the agency can't grant the relief necessary? Is the process inadequate? Would it be futile? As we noted in our brief, plaintiffs have not established any of these factors, and they all weigh in favor of dismissal. There is no evidence of an unreasonable delay here. Plaintiff has never attempted to pursue relief before the flood, such as there would be any basis to believe the delay would ensue. Had they immediately sought that...
Dismissal of the motion for preliminary injunction.
Dismissal of this matter on exhaustion grounds. Plaintiff has never attempted to pursue the relief before the flood. Had they immediately sought this relief, plaintiff would have been fairly far along into the process, if not complete, more than 7 months after the listing decision. And there's no reason to believe review would not take place in an expeditious manner. There are parameters. The timing of the flood, there's timing for the flood of chair to circulate things to their members and to submit questions. The flood of can grant the relief plaintiff seeks, removal, if they meet the necessary standard, and plaintiffs have not asserted, nor can they, that the decision was predetermined here. And as we already have addressed, there's no evidence that the administrative review would be futile here. Listing, again, was based on evidence that plaintiff is working with the government of Xinjiang to recruit, transfer, transport, harbor, or receive forced labor or Uyghurs out of Xinjiang. Again, certainly plaintiffs are in the best position to provide that information and plaintiffs had previously claimed that they weren't able to do so, although I think plaintiff's counsel just said that they could have. Because all of these factors weigh in favor of dismissal here, the court should dismiss this matter and direct plaintiffs to exhaust their remedies before this court is required to make that same determination.
Counsel, could you address the question, I know the statute is a relatively new statute, UFLPA. Whether there have been other efforts to delist made by companies?
There have been other efforts to delist by other companies, my understanding is they're all in the process of review by the FLTF through the process that's set forth in the Federal Register notice. They are participating in all aspects of that process. That's my understanding right now.
Is there some sort of record that's available? In other words, that the process to delist has been triggered by companies?
A public record?
Well, and the fact that they've moved to delist.
I don't know if there's a public record. I can find out. I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I do know that there's several companies that are in the process of the delisting process. The process could be providing information, asking for meetings. I know that there are plaintiffs in all aspects. There are importers companies in all aspects of that process currently. But if you'd like to know whether or not there's a public record of that, I could find out. I mean, I think if there were, it would probably only be a record of whether or not there are entities that are going through the process, not necessarily specifics as to where they might be in that process.
No, I understand. I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, famous last words, a couple of points. First of all, Your Honor, the government appeals to prudential exhaustion. Darby displaces, it forecloses prudential exhaustion. Exhaustion may be required in an APA case only when required expressly by statute, or where the regulatory scheme meets the Darby standards. Those simply are not met here. There's nothing in the UFLPA that requires exhaustion, nothing in the regulatory scheme. So prudential exhaustion is a hypothetical discussion which doesn't apply in this case. Secondly, the government argues that exhaustion is required to develop a useful record for judicial review. I'm pretty sure under the APA, Your Honor, the government is supposed to have already done that, have already compiled an administrative record that supports its decision. If the government proposes to go back to the agency to compile a new record, they've got a Chenery problem. If they want to vacate the decision they have already made and start again, we'd be happy to participate in an agency proceeding where we get to play and submit our evidence. That's not the option that was presented to us. They can't do what Ms. Chirona suggests, Your Honor. Moreover, the process as described by Ms. Chirona is entirely one-sided. NineStar comes in and shares its information with the government. That's fine, but at no point in the description of the process was there a point where we learn what the agency thinks. That's why this process was flawed from the outset. Unless we know not just what they think at a high level, you know, their public statement just lists the list description. We know they think that. We don't know why they think it. Again, this is ex ante. We didn't know why they thought it. Unless we can rebut the specific evidence, the specific links, thin as they are, between NineStar and working with the government of Xinjiang province and why they think we meet the listing requirement, we simply can't rebut it. Lastly, Your Honor, with respect to timing or with respect to futility, Ms. Chirona's representations notwithstanding, there is no process at all for delisting. Your Honor can look at the SOP. It's in the administrative record. The first listings here were in June of 2022, and everyone is still working through the delisting process, apparently. That's a little more than 7 months. Your Honor, the delisting process offers nothing. It's a black hole. Under the APA, we're entitled to come to court to raise our legal issues, and that's what we've done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very quickly, Your Honor. Just to respond to something Mr. Todd just said, there is already an administrative record applicable to this listing decision. What we're referencing is a dismissal and a removal process, which would create a new administrative record, a more fulsome administrative record, for the court to review, if necessary, on the exact same determination that they're asking for here, which is delisting. They're asking for delisting, and what prudential exhaustion argument says is that the court would be able to, if they engage in the proper administrative process, the court would have a more fulsome record in that respect in order to review it. Secondly, there is no evidence that the administrative process that's in place is a black hole. As Mr. Todd already said, he's not even aware of where these are in the process, where all of the requests for removal are in the administrative process. To say that without any, it's a baseless allegation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And I have just one more question, Mr. Todd. So just to understand your position regarding prudential exhaustion, your position is that there's no mandatory exhaustion.
My understanding of Darby, Your Honor, is it forecloses. Well, there is no mandatory exhaustion,
right.
And Darby forecloses prudential exhaustion as well in an APA case. Because the APA, as construed in Darby, Section 10C of the 10C of the APA requires or allows a party subject to a final agency action to go directly to court unless exhaustion is required specifically by statute or required by regulation when the final agency action is suspended pending the review. If you don't meet either of those requirements, exhaustion cannot be required. It's not mandatory and it can't be required prudentially. That's Darby. And then as repeated by the Federal Circuit in the Martinez case that I cited, I think I gave you the cites of that earlier.
Thank you.
That's quite clear. Thank you, Your Honor.
And regarding cites, of course, I will ask parties to the extent that cases have been cited. So some of them have already been cited in briefs, but it would be helpful to the court if there are cases that are cited that haven't been cited before, if you could submit a letter to the court with the citations.
Well, Your Honor, I was going to raise that because your question did spark some additional research and new cases, so we'll do that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I didn't mean to exhaust anybody by those questions, but I have to confess that it's very helpful to understanding sort of the environment, the firmament. Yeah.
It's a great practice.
Thank you.
Yeah, I should have one more comment. I just wanted to point out that there is case, like the Carpenter case, which is also before the CIT, in which they also applied 2637 for purpose of exhaustion requirements. And just to, again, to mention Darby,
there is a statute here that allows for the discretionary decision by the agency, and that's 2637. There's no reason for the court to overlook that on the basis of Darby.
Thank you. That concludes the arguments with respect to exhaustion. We will now move to the closed session. We'll take a recess of 5 minutes, and we will clear the courtroom so that only a public, rather those who are permitted to participate in the closed session will be present.